This is being filmed, so turn off your cell phones, swallow them, whatever one should do, and be aware of that. So if you're crawl on your hands and knees to get food or something like that, I mean, I think that's probably not required, but and then we will, like we did on Tuesday, at the end of the lecture, stop for 1 or 2 minutes. People go get something to eat or drink while others may be leaving, and then we'll reconvene for the questions and answers. Okay, so I'm very pleased tonight to have an important member of the Indian Council who provided some funds for us for this event, and an emeritus professor of endocrinology, but I'm a really noted scientist and an important presence, intellectual presence on campus, Dr. Ved Gosain, to do the introduction.
Thank you, Dean Sherman, and let me welcome you all to the second lecture by Professor Gandhi. As Dean said, my name is Ved Gosain. I've been a faculty member at MSU for a very long time, and now emeritus since January of this year. And the reason I get to stand here and introduce our guest is because I was one of the founding members of India Council and was the director of the India Council for several years after it was endowed back in 1989. So it's a real pleasure and honor for me to introduce Professor Gandhi, who actually needs no introduction. He's been here before, and this is his, to my knowledge, second visit. It could be more. And there are a series of lectures that he is going to give us. He is the grandson of a famous man, but that's not his claim to fame. He is a noted academic, advocate for tolerance and reconciliation. He's been a professor at University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign and a visiting professor here. And today I discovered, he probably doesn't know this, he's a fearless man. I saw him and Mrs. Gandhi cross the Hagadorn Road. And while the traffic signal for pedestrian was not on, Professor Gandhi was courageous enough to cross while Mrs. Gandhi patiently waited. So Professor Gandhi, I'm sorry to tell you that some of our Spartans are not great drivers, and sometimes they may not extend courtesies to pedestrians, so be careful. So once again, it's my pleasure to have Professor Gandhi deliver his second lecture.
It's not always that I'm given a public warning before I start my lecture. Thank you, Professor Ved Gosain, very much for introducing me, and thank you, Dean Sherman Garnett, and thanks to all of you for coming. I respect the stamina of those who sit through long lectures. Now, today's title is Satyagraha, Gandhi's Gift, and also his second subject, just what was Gandhi's religion? As the psychoanalyst Eric Erickson has put it, the boy Mohan, greatly loved by both father and mother, possessed, in Erickson's words, a precocious conscience. An example. In about the middle of 1885, when help was needed by brother Karsan, who had piled up a debt of 25 rupees, younger brother Mohan, now close to 16, clipped a bit of the solid gold from what Karsan wore as an armlet, and the debt was cleared. At this point, Mohan and Karsan were carrying another guilt in their bosoms, their secret eating of meat, which had been prodded by Mehtab's taunts and arguments. The change in the armlet was noticed by women in the joint family who spoke about it, and Mohan decided he would confess his theft. Prudence was at work along with Mohan's conscience. It was wiser and also more honorable to come clean before questions were asked. Probably Mohan also wanted to protect Karsan, who was increasingly seen as the family's black sheep. We may mark that Mohan did not wish to admit his and Karsan's meat-eating, which Mohan had abandoned for the time being, telling himself he would resume it after his parents were no more. Mohan did not dare to speak of his theft to his father, the former Diwan of Porbandar, Rajkot, and Wankaner. He wrote out a confession and handed it to a Sikh, Kaba Gandhi, his father, lying on his back on a plain wooden bed in the Gandhi's Rajkot home. The confession said that his father would now know that his much-loved son was merely a common thief, but the son would steal no more and was asking for forgiveness and also for adequate punishment. The note closed with a request that the father should not punish himself. Here are the well-known words from the autobiography. "I was trembling as I handed the confession. He read it through, and pearl drops trickled down his cheeks, wetting the paper. For a moment, he closed his eyes in thought and then tore up the note. He had sat up to read it. He again lay down. I also cried. I could see my father's agony. If I were a painter, I could draw a picture of the whole scene today. Those pearl drops of love cleansed my heart and washed my sin away." Now, this was a brave deed, and yet, as Erickson points out, the Mohan of this confession seems to be in control. Any anxiety in his mind relates to what might happen to his father, not to him. Very few spaces and very few incidents in a joint family like that of the Gandhis were private. Certainly, Mohan's unusual confession was not private. Everyone knew of it. Everyone remembered it. Gandhi's older sister, Raliyat, who was in her 90s when she died and had survived her brother, never fully forgave the brother's departures from tradition. In old age, she recalled her brother's boyhood confession to Gandhi's biographer, Pyarelal. Now, Gandhi would always claim that his moral journey and political quest were one and the same thing, that the latter flowed from the former, and that he fought for independence, for Hindu-Muslim partnership, and for the ending of high and low, because his conscience demanded these goals. There were times of tension and conflict between the two drives, yet the morally driven Gandhi is a real person, called to be a slave to a force which at different times he calls conscience, or the inner voice, or God. Gandhi is a foe of human domination, but he craves God's domination. He rises against tyranny, but wants to fall on his knees before his conscience or God. Both impulses can be seen at the start of his life, throughout his life, and at the end of his life. The moral and the political came together for Gandhi in South Africa in 1906, when in the hilly terrain of Zululand, he obtained his first clear insight into the potential of nonviolent struggle, or what he would call satyagraha, or clinging to the truth. Before relating that story, let me point out a notable weakness in South Africa's Gandhi. Not only was he confined for much of the time to the Indian cause, he also entertained, especially in his early years in South Africa, and in common with all of the Indian community there, some stereotypical and derogatory views about Africans. On the other hand, there were moments when he revealed an egalitarian outlook on the race question that was remarkably in advance of his times. Yet the struggles of South Africa's blacks and Indians tended to remain separate, if also mutually reinforcing, when Gandhi was there over 100 years ago. After a Zulu chief rejected a new British tax, a white man sent to collect the tax was speared to death. Another white man was also killed. In punishment, 12 Zulus were blown to death at the mouth of a cannon before an audience that included several chiefs. The Zulu revolt persisted, and military action to crush it was announced. In his journal, Indian Opinion, Gandhi wrote in April 1906 of important events, as he put it, the effects of which will not be forgotten for many years, and of great changes likely to take place in South Africa. Quote, "The Indians and other blacks," Gandhi added, "have much to ponder and to act with circumspection." Though he doubted the wisdom of the revolt, Gandhi's sympathy was with the Zulus, who, Gandhi noted, had harmed no Indian. But South Africa's Indian community existed on British permission, and Gandhi and his associates felt they had to support the authorities. In Indian opinion, Gandhi wrote, what is our duty in these calamitous times in the colony? It is not for us to say whether the revolt is justified or not. We are in Natal by virtue of the British power. Our very existence depends upon it. It is therefore our duty to render whatever help we can. To the governor of Natal, Gandhi offered, with, as he put it, the permission of the community, an Indian ambulance corps. The governor accepted the Indian offer, and Gandhi found himself leading a 20-strong corps of 12 South Indians, 5 Gujaratis, 2 from Punjab, and 1 from Calcutta. Of the 20, 14 were Hindus and 6 Muslims. So a Gandhi who wants equal rights for Indians takes an Indian ambulance corps to support British troops who are suppressing a revolt by Natal's native Zulus. If this sounds shocking, we should note that John Dubi, the Zulu leader who would help found the African National Congress and who was Gandhi's friend, said also in 1906 that while the Zulus had serious grievances, quote, at a time like this, we should all refrain from discussing them and assist the government to suppress the rebellion, unquote. For 4 weeks in June, July 1906, the Indian Ambulance Corps served in Mapumulo, Umvoti Valley, Imati Valley in the Zulu country, carrying on stretchers Zulu friendlies mistakenly shot by British soldiers, or nursing Zulu friendlies and Zulu suspects wounded by British lashes. In addition, Gandhi compounded and dispensed prescriptions for wounded or sick white soldiers. He had learned these skills earlier in Durban. Finding that the military exercise he was supporting was above all a manhunt, and hearing rifles exploding, as he would put it, like crackers in innocent hamlets, Gandhi was assailed by qualms. His conscience was somewhat eased by the fact that he and his corps nursed innocent Zulus who would otherwise have been uncared for. The white doctor in charge of ambulance had told Gandhi that white nurses were unwilling to attend to Zulu wounds. With or without the wounded, Gandhi and his colleagues marched long distances, at times 40 miles a day. Gandhi tells us that in his treks through these solemn solitudes, he often fell into deep thought. The psychoanalyst Erickson concludes that the exercises of cleansing the gunshot wounds and binding rents made by the lash aroused in Gandhi, quote, both a deeper identification with the maltreated and a stronger aversion against all forms of male sadism, unquote. Also, and this Erickson does not mention, Gandhi was reminded of India's 1857 rebellion, which had witnessed violence from the Indian side and brutality from the British side, who flogged sympathizers of rebels, blew men off a cannon mouth, and suppressed the revolt. In 1893-94 in South Africa, before Gandhi's hours were swallowed by legal and community work, Gandhi had studied 6 volumes by Kay and Mallison on that 1857 revolt and absorbed the fact that the revolt had consolidated British power in India, even as the Zulu revolt seemed to be doing in South Africa. In Zululand, Gandhi saw fresh proof of that lesson. Being excited into violence against the strong in arms was folly. This was of immediate relevance to South Africa's Indian community. At this precise time, Indians living in South Africa's Transvaal region, with whom Gandhi was in close contact, were agitated about new laws threatening their residence there. If a struggle was required in the Transvaal, which was another part of South Africa, what form should it take? In Zululand, Gandhi concluded that any Indian struggle would have to be nonviolent. Also, he reached decisions on personal questions on which he had been reflecting for some time. One was that he should possess the strength and flexibility of the celibate or the brahmachari, in the Indian phrase. Indian tradition honored such a person. In Gandhi's view, so did Christianity. He thought that celibacy would make him more effective in future struggles. Secondly, Gandhi decided he should free himself from the drag of possessions. By now, Gandhi and his wife Kastur had 4 sons. Henceforth, he would not live for wealth or sex or for expanding his family. The less he had, the more he would become. He also envisioned a personal role. Later, he would say, "A mission came to me in 1906, namely, to spread truth and nonviolence among mankind in the place of violence and falsehood in all walks of life," unquote. He had found a new purpose for his life, demonstrating satyagraha to the world. His weapon for realizing the goal of Indian independence, satyagraha would also foster Hindu-Muslim friendship and the ending of high and low. It would integrate Gandhi's passions. And whereas many others in India also aimed at independence and at Hindu-Muslim unity and social equality, although not perhaps with Gandhi's intensity, satyagraha was his unique gift to India and the world. Quote, "My people were excited," he would recall in 1931, referring to the year 1906 and the crisis before the Transvaal Indians, quote, "and there was talk of wreaking vengeance. I had then to choose between allying myself to violence or finding out some other method of meeting the crisis. And it came to me that we should refuse to obey legislation that was degrading and let them put us in jail if they liked," unquote. 2 months after his Zulu treks ended, the Transvaal Indians, led by Gandhi, launched their first nonviolent defiance, or as it would soon be called, satyagraha, with Gandhi saying on 11 September 1906, let me repeat the date, 11 September, quote, "I can boldly declare and with certainty that so long as there are even a handful of men true to their pledge, there can only be one end to the struggle, and that is victory," unquote. This is what he said in that year. Thus, a battlefield exercise conducted with an uneasy conscience became a laboratory and a springboard for Gandhi. Holding that the turning point in Gandhi's personal life came in 1906 in Zululand, the scholar Jonathan Schell reminds us that whereas in both East and West, holy vows have usually been accompanied by withdrawal from the world and from politics, Gandhi proceeded in exactly the opposite direction. His vows had freed him not from, but for action. Let us look again at the man behind satyagraha. Hindu tradition held that renouncers obtain power, and Gandhi claimed to see that truth also in the cross. For the Indian people, Gandhi's appeal was certainly enhanced by his simple lifestyle, his vows, his fasts, his barefoot walks, and his refusal to give or seek special treatment to members of his family. At times, his eldest son, Harilal, charged that for his personal ambition, the father sacrificed his sons. And in September 1901, 5 years before the Zululand experience, there was this interesting exchange in Durban between a Gandhi a month short of his 32nd birthday and his wife, who was a few months older than him. After several years in Durban, the couple, their 4 sons, Harilal, 13, Manilal, 9, Ramdas, 3, and Devdas, 1, and a 13-year-old nephew, Gokul, the son of sister Raliyat, who had been widowed, were returning to India. For good, as everyone thought, including Gandhi, but this was an erroneous impression. Summoned by the community, Gandhi would in fact return to South Africa in 1902. As a lawyer and community leader, the Gandhi about to leave Durban had done a good deal for the Indians of Natal. To show appreciation, the community and clients had given costly presents, a gold necklace for Kastur, other gold chains, gold watches, diamond rings. Most gifts came from the community, some from clients. After an evening when many gifts were given, an agitated Gandhi spent a sleepless night. Should a public servant accept gifts? Since his clients too were helpers in public work, should he take what they had given? Later, Gandhi truthfully recalled, quote, "It was difficult for me to forego gifts worth hundreds of pounds." But he found it more difficult to keep the gifts. That night, he drafted a letter, placing the presents in a trust for the community. In the morning, he held what he called a consultation with Kastur, but only after securing the agreement of the boys. Apparently, the 3 older boys, Harilal, Gokul, and Manilal, not only told their father that they did not need the presents, they also agreed to persuade their mother. This did not prove easy. Kastur fought with passion and logic both. The boys might dance to his tune, she told Gandhi, but what about my future daughters-in-law? The future was unknown, and she would be the last person to part with gifts so lovingly given. She cried too. Gandhi said the boys would not marry young. When they did marry, their wives would be free from the lure of ornaments. If, however, ornaments were needed, Kastur could ask him. Ask you? I know you by this time. You deprived me of my ornaments. Fancy you offering to get ornaments for my daughters-in-law. You who are trying to make sadhus of my boys from today. Erickson's translation of the last remark is, you want them to be saints before they are men. Saying, no, the ornaments will not be returned, Kastur asked a proper legal question. And pray, what right have you to my necklace? In a pitiless legal reply, Gandhi asked if the necklace was given for her service or his. I agree, Kastur said. But she added, service rendered by you is as good as rendered by me. I have toiled and moiled for you day and night. Is that no service? You force all and sundry on me, making me weep bitter tears, and I slaved for them. Gandhi would recall later, these were pointed thrusts, and some of them went home. But his mind was made up. In his own words, he, quote, somehow succeeded in extorting her consent. The gifts were all returned. If we feel that this 1901 consultation was loaded in his favor, and that the boys had been unfairly enlisted by the father, it is perhaps good also to recognize that we only know of this conversation because a Gandhi aware of his pressure recalled it. In 1924, after speaking in his journal, Young India, of my own dearest relatives, Gandhi added, sometimes love's anguish left deep scars on the loved ones, but it left deeper ones on the lover's bosom. When in January 1928, Gandhi's third son, Ram Das, married Nirmala Vora at the Sabarmati Ashram, a wedding arranged by parents, the Gandhi's gift to the couple were a copy of the Gita, another of prayer songs, a takli or spindle for spinning, and two rosaries made of thread spun by Gandhi. Speaking after a short religious ceremony, Gandhi choked while acknowledging the poverty he had imposed on his sons. Ram Das was asked to be the bride's true friend and not her master. You will both earn your bread by the sweat of your brow as poor people do, said Gandhi. Let the Gita be to you a mine of diamonds. Now, most of the time, there was no one with whom Gandhi could talk of his heartaches. Not, for instance, when as a 22-year-old, he heard on landing in India from London that the mother he was pining to see had died. Most of my cherished hopes were shattered, he would write more than 30 years later. Not when Rasik, a loved 17-year-old grandson, died, though Gandhi, who had helped raise Rasik, who was the son of Gandhi's oldest son, Harilal, wrote a piece on Rasik that he headlined, Sunset in the Morning. This bearer of India's hopes, this searcher after truth, who was always on the give, consoling and giving courage, almost never himself received the reassuring words, I understand you, I feel for you, or I love you. In his moments of trial, only God solaced him, or his conscience, or an inner spirit. In 1935, Harilal's indiscretions produced unhappy headlines. Kasturba wrote to the son, your father does not speak anything about this before anybody, but the shock breaks his heart to pieces. The most humanly dramatic lines in Gandhi's life, whether of heartbreak or accomplishment, grief or ecstasy, were ones he could not utter. He seemed to have no one to utter to. Once in a while, a solitary Gandhi would transmit his emotion via pen to paper and share it with the world. More often, He vented it in silent communion with his Maker, and he always bounced back. We know of his unfulfilled desire in his early 20s, right after he returned from his London law studies, to be a writer. He was deflected from pursuing that desire by his confrontation with Charles Ollivant, which put him on the path to South Africa and a lifelong fight against domination. In the autumn of 1936, a 67-year-old Gandhi, who had just started a new ashram in central India, far from his native Gujarat, was asked to preside at a gathering of Gujarati writers in Ahmedabad, where he had his earlier ashram. Addressing the writers, he remembered his unfulfilled wish and came out with intriguing sentences. "I have some interests which I cannot satisfy. A good many of these have become extinguished. Anand Shankar Bhai," Gandhi refers to a famous scholar, "told me that a poetry symposium was held here. I'd wish to go to the lecture on the archaeological work in Indore," so he's interested in poetry and archaeology, "but these are extinguished desires. But I went neither to the lecture nor attended the poetry symposium. I have settled in a village, Sevagram, Segaon, which I did not go seeking, but which came to me. Likewise, I had not gone looking around for Satyagraha, it came to me." Continues Gandhi, "Many of the women from this village in Sevagram give their love to me, much against my will. If, however, I were to accept their love, my vow of faithfulness to my wife would be put to shame. Hence, I regard them as my mothers. When I went to South Africa, I took some Gujarati books with me. Taylor's Gujarati Grammar was one of them. I like it very much, so I'm sure all of you also love your grammar books. There was a time when a large number of women," continues Gandhi, "stayed with me in South Africa. I had become father or brother to women belonging to about 60 families. They were pretty women, as well as plain ones among them. Although these women were illiterate, I brought out the courage in them, and they went to jail as bravely as men." Now, here we may mark that most scholars in the final 15 years of his life thought that Gandhi looked youthful rather than old, and also striking despite his large ears, like those of Mickey Mouse, as a later generation would say, and a similarly large nose that pointed downwards, with the lower lip pushing up to meet the nose. His laughter was especially noticed. He smiled, he grinned, he chuckled, he crackled, he laughed heartily, and usually those meeting him found themselves laughing too. As Nehru said, Gandhi brought a breeze to a room he entered. Here is what William Shirer, the author of Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, said after one of several meetings he had with Gandhi in the 1930s and 1940s. "In no time at all, Gandhi had us all laughing and completely at our ease. If in this world of varied personalities, there is a single man even half as charming as Gandhi, I have not met him." And he enjoyed other people's jokes. Writing in 1932 from a Pune prison to a friend in southern India, Srinivas Shastri, Gandhi said, "Sardar Vallabh Bhai is with me. His jokes make me laugh until I can laugh no more, not once but several times a day." Yet, Gandhi's gaiety was matched by a discernible presence of sorrow. Nehru noticed, quote unquote, "deep pools of sadness in Gandhi's twinkling eyes." And Hansa Mehta, one of the many talented women who joined Gandhi's movement after the Salt March, spoke for other sensitive observers too, when she referred to a great pathos in Gandhi, adding, quote, "I always felt deeply moved in his presence," unquote. Some of the sadness undoubtedly came from the self-suppression we have looked at. He couldn't do what he had wanted to do. Then there was his eldest son, Harilal, who seldom stayed in one place or held down a job or looked after his children. Every reminder of Harilal's distress was a knife stab for his parents. A toll was taken too by Gandhi's inner conflicts, including over who at any given time were more his people or family than others, and over how hard or soft he should be with those close to him. Another layer of suppressed unhappiness may have been found by a tension we will look at later in this lecture, between the voice of universal truth and the voice of India. One person who recognized Gandhi's need for human warmth was Tagore's niece, Sarala Devi Chowdhurani, who had involved herself in militant nationalism between 1903 and 1905. 3 years younger than Gandhi, she had first met him in Calcutta at the end of 1901, but it was not until 18 years later when this Bengali lady was the 47-year-old wife of a prominent public figure in Lahore in Punjab that she grew close to Gandhi, who spent several months in 1919-20 in Punjab. Within days of his arrival in Lahore in October 1919, Gandhi would write to a close associate in Ahmedabad, Anasuya Sarabhai, quote, "Sarala Devi's company is very endearing. She looks after me very well," unquote. The following months saw a special relationship between the two, with the 50-year-old Gandhi overcoming an earlier caution he had expressed regarding exclusive relationships and briefly thinking of, quote, "a spiritual marriage," as he thought of it, with Sarala Devi. We have to conclude that Sarala Devi conveyed to Gandhi an aesthetic, political, and possibly erotic appeal. She wrote, spoke, and sang well. Politically, she represented a Tagore connection. She represented the province of Bengal, and from her past, she represented the strand of patriotic violence. Gandhi may have imagined a merger with her, helping him win all of India to nonviolent satyagraha. Whether or not he consciously toyed with such considerations, they probably influenced him. But this unusual 7-month relationship ended in June 1920. Gandhi's 20-year-old son Devadas, his 28-year-old secretary Mahadev Desai, a nephew Mathuradas Trikamdas, grandson of his half-sister Muliben, and a close South Indian political associate Chakravarti Rajagopalachari, or CR, who was 9 years younger than Gandhi, had asked Gandhi to think of the consequences for Kasturba, for people like them, and for Gandhi himself if he continued the special relationship, with CR warning Gandhi that he was nursing a most dreadful delusion. 13 years later, in 1933, Gandhi would say that he had been saved from rushing into hellfire by the thought of Kasturba and because of interventions by Devadas, Desai, and Mathuradas. In 1935, Gandhi told Margaret Sanger, who met him there in India, after referring to Kasturba's illiteracy, that he had, quote unquote, nearly slipped after meeting a woman with a broad cultural education, but had fortunately been freed from a trance. Shattered when Gandhi informed her that their relationship could not continue, Sarala Devi complained that she had put in one pan all the joys and sorrows of the world, joys and pleasures of the world, and in the other, Bapu and his laws, and committed the folly of choosing the latter. Bapu means father, and that's how many people refer to Gandhi. She demanded an explanation, which Gandhi finally tried to offer in a letter he sent in December 1920. Quote, "I've been analyzing my love for you. I've reached a definition of spiritual marriage. It is a partnership between two persons of the opposite sex where the physical is wholly absent. It is therefore possible between brother and sister, father and daughter. It is possible only between two brahmacharis, two celibates in thought, word and deed." Continues Gandhi, "Have we that exquisite purity, that perfect coincidence, that perfect merging, that identity of ideals, the self-forgetfulness, that fixity of purpose, that trustfulness? For me, I can answer plainly that it is only an aspiration. I'm unworthy of that companionship with you. This is the big letter I promised. With dearest love, I still subscribe myself, your LG." The initial stood for lawgiver, the title with which she used to tease Gandhi. The letter could not, of course, assuage Sarala Devi's feelings, but it reveals the struggle in Gandhi's heart. In the years that followed, Sarala Devi criticized Gandhi at times accusing him of allowing nonviolence to break out in hatred, at other times saying that he possessed, as she called it, a Christo-Buddhist heart rather than a Hindu frame of mind. Communication did not cease, however. In the 1940s, at her instance, Gandhi suggested her son Deepak's name to Jawaharlal Nehru as a possible match for his daughter Indira. That idea did not work out, but after Sarla Devi and Gandhi were both no more, Deepak married Radha, the daughter of Gandhi's nephew and close colleague, Maganlal Gandhi. Sarla Devi and Gandhi had known of this romance. She passed away in 1945. Her husband had died in 1923. So who was Gandhi's god? What was his religion? The joint family in which Mohandas was raised was loyal to the Vaishnava tradition it had inherited, which called for ceremonies at temples of Rama and Krishna. And the older Gandhi would often refer to the Ramayana story, which was frequently recited in his boyhood home. More liberal than others from his Vaishnava jati, subcaste, Gandhi's parents also worshipped at the rival Shiva temple, and their home was often visited by Jain monks. At times, Muslim and Zoroastrian friends visited Kaaba Gandhi in his home and talked about their faiths. But the boy Mohan harbored a bias against Christianity. He had felt offended, he informs us, when in his hearing a European preacher slighted Hindu gods at a corner near the high school. Equally, the creation story in an ancient Hindu text, the Manusmriti, which the boy Mohan found among his father's religious books, not only did not impress him very much, as he put it, it made him incline somewhat towards atheism, a position strengthened by Mohan's daydreams in the company of Karsan and Mehtab of driving out the British. The three London years removed the atheism and the bias against Christianity. It also taught young Gandhi the truths of the Gita and also of Buddhism. In London, he read Edwin Arnold's Song Celestial, a translation of the Bhagavad Gita. Curiously enough, he had not come across the Gita in Rajkot. In London, he also read Arnold's Light of Asia, which told the Buddha story. For the rest of his life, Gandhi spoke of the Song Celestial as the best English translation of the Gita, which would become an inseparable part of his life, and on which he wrote a significant commentary himself in the 1920s. His London years also gave to Gandhi a lifelong interest in Christianity, which to begin with brought him close to a conversion. In London, he heard famous preachers, including Charles Spurgeon, the Congregationalist Joseph Parker, and Frederick William Farrar, who would become Dean of Canterbury. He read the Bible and was bowled over, in his words, by the Sermon on the Mount. In his first year in South Africa, Gandhi went down on his knees many times along with Christian friends who were praying for him. And he journeyed to attend a great Christian convention in Wellington, 40 miles from Cape Town. In the end, Gandhi decided that he would accept metaphorically, but not literally, that by his death, Jesus had redeemed the sins of the world. And he could not see Jesus as the only incarnate Son of God. Leo Tolstoy's The Kingdom of God is Within You, which he read in South Africa in 1894, overwhelmed Gandhi, as he would say, and the five commandments underlined by Tolstoy from the Sermon on the Mount, do not hate, do not lust, do not hoard, do not kill, love your enemies, went directly to Gandhi's heart. In a talk in Ahmedabad in 1928, Gandhi recalled the impact Tolstoy's book had made on him. Quote, "When I went to England as a student, I was a votary of violence. I had faith in violence and none in nonviolence. After I read Tolstoy's book, that lack of faith in nonviolence vanished." Also in South Africa, the businessman who had hired him, Abdullah Shet, asked Gandhi to study Islam. Gandhi read Sale's translation of the Quran and other Islamic books. Unconvinced that he should embrace Christianity or Islam, and not certain either that Hinduism, with its untouchability and a multitude of sects and castes, was a perfect religion, Gandhi remembered a key thought from Jainism, which was that doubt should accompany every certainty. To his friend in India, Raj Chandra, a Jain who was a poet, a jeweler, and a scholar of Jainism and Hinduism, Gandhi sent 26 questions about God. This is when Gandhi is 24. Questions about God, Christ, Rama, Krishna, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, and more. In October 1894, Raj Chandra sent careful answers and books on Hinduism and recommended patience, quote, somewhat pacified, unquote. Gandhi remained a loyal Hindu who would, however, look at Hindu texts in the light of reason and morality. The Gandhi who fought hard for Hindu temples to open their doors to long-excluded untouchables was not himself a temple goer, nor did he keep images of Hindu gods in his home or hut. Rama, Ram, was his favorite name for God, but he was equally comfortable with Krishna, God, Khuda, Allah, Yahweh, or any other name. And although he often recalled a moral from the Ramayana, he did not see that text as history. The Rama whom I adore, Gandhi would explain, is God himself, different from any historical Rama. He always was, is now, and will be forever, a God who was unborn and uncreated. This eternal God of Gandhi did not have a special relationship with a geographical area. Gandhi's Hinduism was more moral than racial or national, linked more to his soul than to the soil of India. He approached this eternal God through prayer, both silent and voiced, and his multi-faith prayers, joined by many, included short texts from different faiths, as well as prayer songs from different traditions. When Stuart Nelson, Dean of Washington, D.C.'s Howard University, traveled to Noakhali in January 1947 to meet him, Gandhi the Hindu got Nelson to sing a Christian song, O God Our Help, in ages past, to a largely Muslim audience in the village of Srirampur, with Gandhi translating that song. If we imagine that scene, we get an idea of Gandhi's God. In 1928, Gandhi offered this rhythmic declaration of his faith in God. In the midst of death, life persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. In the midst of darkness, light persists. Hence I gather that God is life, truth, light. He is love. He is the supreme good. Among the many witnesses Gandhi invoked to prove God's love were India's poet saints like Kabir, Nanak, Tulsidas, Chaitanya, Narsi Mehta, Tukaram, and also Paul of Tarsus, whose first letter to the Corinthians was among Gandhi's favorite texts. And though he spoke of longings to attain perfection, Gandhi always identified himself with petitioners to the Almighty, who saw themselves as poor sinners. At the peak of his huge non-cooperation movement of 1921, Gandhi called himself a weak, frail, miserable human being. Often he spoke of a God who directly and personally aided human beings, as in Abbottabad, the frontier province, in July 1939. Quote, the greatest of things in this world are accomplished not through unaided human effort. Or, as he said to friend Anand Hingorani in 1945, God is proving for me his greatness and goodness every day. I can't even count the blessings, there are so many, for even the so-called sorrows and pains he sends descend like blessings. Or as he put it in Noakhali on 10 January 1947, speaking to his grandniece and helper Manu, just observe how God sustains me. Though I sleep at 10 or 11, rise at 2 or 2:30, do my work at high pressure and get no rest at all, I carry on somehow. That itself is a wonder. In the pre-dawn hours of 1 June 1947, having woken up even earlier than usual, he mused on his isolation from men like Nehru and Patel, loyal colleagues for 30 years who had now opted for the partition he had deeply disliked. Manu recorded his words. Today I find myself all alone. But somehow, in spite of my being all alone, in my thoughts, I'm experiencing an ineffable inner joy and freshness of mind. I feel as if God himself was lighting my path before me, which is why I'm able to fight on single-handed. On 18 January 1948, after ending his last fast, Gandhi explained why instead of God, he spoke at times of truth. I embarked on the fast, he said, in the name of truth, whose familiar name is God. In the name of God, we have indulged in lies, massacres, without caring whether people were innocent or guilty, men or women, children or infants. We have indulged in abductions, forcible conversions, and we have done all this shamelessly. I'm not aware if anybody has done these things in the name of truth. With that same name on my lips, I have broken the fast. About an earlier fast in 1933, he said more than once that an inner voice he heard had urged him to undertake it. His close associate, Vinoba Bhave, probed him on this. You have said that truth is God, but you've also said during your fast you heard the inner voice. Now, what was that? Gandhi answered, yes, there was something like that. It was not anything usual. I heard the voice clearly. I asked, what should I do? The answer was, you should fast. I asked, for how long? The reply was, for 21 days. He said to Vinoba, I felt God was talking to me. So Vinoba says, I said, does God have a form? Gandhi replied, if a voice can be heard, perhaps the face too can be seen. But he admitted he had not seen God. Now the cross was a magnet for Gandhi. In October 1946, after violence had erupted in Noakhali, and two of his Bengali associates, Satish Chandra Das Gupta, a scientist and inventor, and Satin Sen expressed willingness to assist in Noakhali. After these two Bengali associates expressed willingness to assist him in Noakhali, Gandhi spoke to them of Jesus' example of perfect sacrifice. Gandhi said, a man who was completely innocent offered himself as a sacrifice for the good of others, including his enemies, and became the ransom of the world. It was a perfect act. It is finished, were the last words of Jesus. And we have the testimony of his, this is Gandhi continuing, and we have the testimony of his four disciples as to its authenticity. But whether the Jesus tradition is historically true or not, I do not care. A year later, on 26 October 1947, when Gandhi was striving to bring security to its Muslims, and some Hindu groups spoke freely of their dislike of God, Gandhi said to a group of Delhi's Muslim leaders who kept him posted day after day on their community situation, quote, Jesus Christ prayed to God from the cross to forgive those who had crucified him. It is my constant prayer to God that he may give me the strength to intercede even for my assassin. And it should be your prayer too, he says to the Muslims of Delhi, that your faithful servant may be given that strength to forgive. This champion of nonviolence, love and forgiveness was not, however, a pacifist. Not only did he take part, albeit with an ambulance corps, in the suppression of violence in Zululand, he raised an ambulance corps for World War I. He even tried to recruit Indian soldiers for that war. In 1942, when he mounted the Quit India campaign, that campaign promised that a free India would permit Allied troops to remain in India to prosecute the war. True, he did on occasion say, in October 39, for example, that it is better for India to discard violence altogether, even for defending her borders. However, shortly after independence, when Afridi tribesmen, armed and equipped by the Pakistani army, marched into Kashmir, and the Indian government sent troops to protect Kashmir, Gandhi, in his own words, gave tacit support for the action. Yet in July 1940, Gandhi had asked the British people to let Hitler take possession of their land and oppose the Nazis solely with non-violent non-cooperation. This was purely theoretical advice, rendered in the context of a dispute within the Indian National Congress on whether or not to accept a vague British offer of possible future independence provided the Congress enlisted in the war. Convinced that Prime Minister Churchill had no intention to let go of India, Gandhi also argued that a deal with the empire would militarize India. When pro-deal colleagues led by Rajagopalachari asked, "Can Hitler be opposed without arms?" Saying yes, Gandhi went on to make that unrealistic suggestion to the British people. This was the professor of nonviolence, underlining its universal applicability in order to buttress his practical advice against accepting what he thought was an insincere offer from the empire. After the war ended and independence too had come, Gandhi publicly complimented Churchill for leading his country in World War II. This was 7 years after he had given his theoretical advice to the British. There was no doubt, Gandhi said on 28 September 1947, that Churchill, who, quote, Gandhi's words, took the helm when Great Britain was in great danger, had saved the British Empire. As Gandhi well knew, Churchill had done so with guns and bombs. There were moments when the voice of Ahimsa, nonviolence, and the voice of the leader of India's independence movement did not coincide. The inconsistent Mahatma was also a very human and very Indian Mohandas Gandhi. Thank you.